Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 182 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. This week, we want to highlight Critical Mass, which is the Young Adult Cancer Alliance.
Now, if you're an elderly person, or if someone is older, say 70, 80, and they develop cancer, a 95% chance of surviving 5 years is awesome. I mean, any time that you're surviving is time on this earth. It's not as meaningful, one could say, to someone who's maybe 14, to say that you have a 95% chance of making 5 years. Yes, it's time on this earth with family, with friends, but it's 5 years. So you're looking at maybe 20 as opposed to maybe 85.
Critical Mass is all about collaboration, bringing young people together, especially those who have seen firsthand the devastation caused in a young person's life because of cancer, from the patient to the pharmaceutical rep.
But together, we can create a world where adolescents and young adults diagnosed with cancer have no barriers to survive and thrive.
So now is your chance to take action by giving today. Are you listening from your phone? If not, get your phone out. I'll give you a minute. Now text CRITICAL, CRITICAL. Why did I spell that? Y'all are book readers. To 82623. That's text CRITICAL to 82623.
As Summer said, text CRITICAL to 82623 to join the movement today. Message and data rates may apply, and you can learn more at criticalmass.org.
Critical Mass. It's time to transform the care and treatment of adolescents and young adults impacted by cancer. And now, on to our read-along! Chapter 27, entitled Up in Flames.
But before we go on, we have a guest again.
Candida!
So, chapter 27, Up in Flames. Now, the good thing about this chapter, well, it's all Diana, so it's all good. But this was, I don't know how much we'll laugh. We'll probably laugh just because we're all talking together. But there, I laughed reading this. It's quite a funny chapter. Even given what happens, it's quite entertaining and touching. But it has everything. So after wandering around for at least an hour or so, this is from looking back at chapter 26, without a full wardrobe, Claire finally gets dressed. And the scene opens, the chapter opens. They are in Mowbray's Tavern. Deborah C. writes, Jamie knew which prostitute's dress would fit Claire, mirroring what he said on his wedding night. Quote, I said I was a virgin, not a monk. Jamie says, quote, I said I didn't abed with the lasses. I never said I didn't look at them. Unquote. Lisa T. writes, the chapter opens with Claire curious and questioning Jamie yet again about his relationship with women. It has been 20 years and she knows Jamie well enough to know that he can't have slept alone all this time. Yet again, Jamie being Jamie knows exactly what to say. And just in case we needed a reminder, she quotes, I longed to untie Jamie's hair from its formal plait and run my hands up under it to feel the solid curve of his skull and the soft strands tangled in my fingers. I could still recall the tickle of it spilling loose and rich across my breasts in the morning light, unquote.
Is breasts a new problem word for you?
No, I just didn't expect it. She continues or finishes. It's also okay. So remember, I'll finish the quote. I'll say that. Oh, okay. I could still recall the tickle of it spilling loose and rich across my breasts in the morning light, unquote. And Lisa T says, it's also exactly what Lord John wanted to do. Madame Jeanne has called Jamie Monsieur Fraser, but that's not what he goes by in public. At the moment, though, he's Sawney Malcolm, printer and publisher. Now, Sawney is what they say in the Highlands, he tells Claire, not Sandy. That's more lowlands.
Or maybe this was Diana's way of reminding readers, because it's, I mean, we're three books. This is the third book. We might have forgotten about Sawney. I mean, we wouldn't have, but some people might have.
We're just a little bit obsessed. So besides Sawney, she also questions, she knows she's his wife, but she questions, she's like, okay, so let's just make sure I know who you are right now so I don't say the wrong thing. And then whoever you are, who am I? Because I need to know my name. And he says, you're my wife, Sassenach, always. And of course, at this moment, that means she's Mrs. Malcolm. And S says, it starts off with a strange bit of amnesia from Claire. She seems to have forgotten Sawney the snake, one of the very few possessions Jamie keeps with him always. And that Sawney, not Sandy, really Claire, is the name for Alexander.
Well, maybe maybe she didn't realize that the snake's name was a nickname. Maybe she thought his name was just Sawney.
Oh, the snake was just randomly named Sawney.
Maybe
when it was a gift to a dude named Alexander, or with a name of Alexander somewhere in there.
I mean, I'm not.
I mean, dude, you're not defending it. I know.
No, I'm just saying that maybe, because technically, not everyone is used as a nickname for a nickname for a longer name. A lot of people have nicknames for first names. Like, I have a friend whose name is Jill. It's not short for Jillian. Her name is legally Jill, even though everyone else knows Jill as a nickname for Jillian. So there's a chance that his name could have literally just been Sawney. The snake.
The snake. Okay. Martina P. writes, some more romantic moments and beautiful conversations between Jamie and Claire in the tavern. Claire is filled with delight when talked to and introduced as Jamie's wife, no matter what the name may be at the moment. She tells us that she feels like a new bride. I love Jamie's story about becoming a printer. Unable to be a warrior, laird, or soldier, a printer seems a good profession for Jamie. Anne S. writes, then comes one of my favorite sections when Claire and Jamie are eating the soup. Who knew soup would end up being so erotic? And Jamie, clearly and sweetly, has just one thing on his mind. And the devil can take anyone who gets in his way. Sigh. Deborah C. writes, at Mowbray's Tavern, they enjoy a Tom Jones type of meal, with sexual overtones and sultry looks that scandalize the other guests. After making love upstairs, we get to the real intimacy that makes the couple so special and endearing. Jamie says, quote, it's no just the bedding you can, to have you with me again, to talk with you, to know I can say anything, not guard my words or hide my thoughts. God, Sassenach, the Lord knows I am lust-crazed as a lad, and I cannot keep my hands from you, or anything else. But I would count that all well lost had I no more than the pleasure of having you by me and to tell you all my heart. Unquote.
Seriously, no other dude ever has a chance with any woman who's ever with
him. So that's another reason you don't want your 16 or 13 year old daughter to read this. She will never find someone.
She'll never.
So because that paragraph that I just read was from a listener, I didn't want to split up their comment, but because we included their entire comment, we have to go back a tiny bit and talk about the visitor who harshed their mellow. So, of course, the visitor introduces himself by saying, a good day to you. I trust I do not intrude. Okay, if you go up to someone and say something like before that, if you go up and kind of stand there expectantly trying to have someone give you their attention and they don't stop what they're doing and like literally and willingly give you their full attention and you dare say, I trust I do not intrude. Dude, no.
And this is where I take issue with what him happens interrupting to me? Jamie's tongue flicking in between.
Seriously, this is me every day at work. They walk into the office and my back is to the door and I keep my face into my computer and they'll stand there. No, but they'll stand there. They'll stand there and I'm ignoring them until they're finally like, hi, excuse me. And I was like, ugh.
And then I turn around and I'm like, hi, how can I help you?
Licking your fingers that won't interrupt you.
Oh my goodness.
I'll just start making out with my computer screen from now on. No one ever disturbs you then. They're like, that bitch is cray.
Now the dude who was bugging them says his employer would like a word with him. The employer's name is Sir Percival Turner. Jamie's like, sorry, nope, later, dude, later, alligator. Alabada.
What?
Later, alligator. maybe I do need to drink. Right? Because I'm not, and it's clearly not helping. Then someone comes up to them and congratulates them on their marriage. And this man was Sir Percival. So obviously they had been talking about their names or their Mr. and Mrs. kind of thing. And Sir Percival has the gout. He'd tried to get in touch with Jamie via a note sent to the print shop. And he tells him that he cannot advise a trip north just then. He cites the weather and he strongly advises them to remain in Edinburgh. Now, this is at least the second time, I think only the second time we've heard this. It was again in either chapter 26 or 25, but there was mention of there's a ship north, you shouldn't go, something like that. And then they go upstairs and they do have funsies. Now, Claire recites a Latin quote she remembers from one of her medical texts. Post coitum omne animalium triste est. Every animal is sad after smexy time. Jamie starts talking about how various animalia look after smexy time. And they discuss just how lonely they were without each other. Now, the funny thing here is it is a very endearing and it's a hilarious conversation they have. But the funniest thing is not necessarily what Claire says, but that Jamie's got a list of like 20 animals he describes.
He's been busy watching animals do it.
Claire. I mean, little dudes. Yeah, little dudes.
Have you been saying, what are you saying? Smaxy time?
Smaxy. She thinks it's cute. It's not.
I didn't say it was cute.
Well, you kept saying it, so clearly you think it's cute.
No, I'm saying it because instead of the other thing.
You don't want to say sexy?
I guess not, huh?
Hashtag sexy. Hashtag
good lord. What's funny is that last time I said this and we weren't recording, you didn't ask a darn thing. You just let me go. And now we are recording and you're like, wait, what are you saying?
Well, I think that she secretly knew we weren't recording and didn't want to waste her breath. But what I think's funny about that whole interchange is then afterwards she's like, I don't remember you making any weird faces. And he goes, well, you had your eyes closed.
So they discuss just how lonely they were without each other. How nice it is, they say, to have someone they can unburden themselves to. And Jamie says, it's nice to have someone that whom he doesn't have to guard his thoughts or his speech around. There's time before they have to go meet Ian at the print shop, so they get some munchies and Jamie starts to talk. Eileen P. writes, I like that Jamie makes sure Claire knows that he is not just happy she is back so that they can make love. It's so much more than physical. He can once again speak unguardedly and share his heart with her. They were both so lonely without the other.
Jamie's always been this way with her ever since they had that little impromptu lunch at the stable when he told her about his past and how he was a wanted man and his real name. And here he was revealing all these secrets to somebody he didn't know and that was English, but there was something about her that he connected to and he knew he could trust her. And it's just always been that way.
Yeah, but at the time she was English in Scotland. Who was going to listen to her?
Well, at the time they were still wondering if she was a spy though, remember? I mean, that was like the very next morning she was already hitting on him, so.
True. Touche.
Don't touch me.
I would never.
Well, then don't say touche.
En guard.
At least to your sister. You can touche someone else, just not your Schwester. Dude. Lisa touché. T continues. So hot, so funny. The conversation continues, and Jamie is at his earthy best, not unlike their wedding night. Snakes with twa tails.
I so thought you were just going to say twat.
Of course.
Snake with twat ales.
And when Jamie describes some of the animals as fair depraved, Lisa T continues, fair depraved is just so funny. I hope we get to see a bit of this in season 3. And she continues again, the fact that they have each had it. shocker.
No. You better keep that in.
I can't do this. I better not keep that in.
This is radar.
No, it's Patreon. Not.
That's the Patreon.
Patreon does not get my
it doesn't?
No.
Isn't that the whole point of Patreon?
No. Not to
you say that. You like your say fucker fucker? Monkey nipples.
No, that's just gross. Stop
no,
it.
What you're saying. Gross.
It's all bad. And now it's getting late and I'm getting punch drunk.
Hubba, hubba.
Wait, hubba, hubba,
hubba?
Did you just say hubba, hubba?
No, I said.
Where'd the monkey get the nickel?
From my pocket. He's a thief, not, a dirty thief.
Not from our government. No. This is bad. Okay, I'm going to try it again.
Okay.
The fact that they have each had other lovers is not so important because their bond is not just a physical one. Ooh. If it were, BJR would have destroyed it years ago. Claire and Jamie are human, sexual beings, and have been apart for 20 years. They never stopped loving each other, but they never thought they would ever be together again. The fact that they have had other lovers is completely natural. The next morning, there's a scheduled rendezvous for Jamie the smuggler. He doesn't know what the warning from Sir Percival was about, but it might be someone that is in the area who might be giving them trouble. So as they reminisce about his stay in Wentworth Prison, Claire explains that she is now a surgeon, but that doesn't mean the same thing in her time as it does in theirs. And we get one of Diana's best explanations, completely accurate, and also completely descriptive, of Claire. Quote, a surgeon tries to effect healing by means of a knife, unquote. And Jamie sees in her absolutely clearly what Frank hadn't ever seen.
See, now I think that's kind of not giving Frank a ton of credit, because he's the one who urged her to go to medical school.
Yeah, I agree.
So while he did kind of take it back and be a dick at the end, his intentions were kind of honorable in the beginning when he urged her to go to medical school. So
Eileen P. writes, Jamie describes Claire as a knife, one that is a clever worked scabbard, but tempered steel for a core and wicked sharp edge. He understands the immense capacity of Claire's strength. This is something Frank either never understood, denied, or suppressed. Yet Jamie sees who Claire is and recognizes that she has grown in strength due to her experiences. Claire refers to Mrs. Graham and how she'd said lines in one's hand don't predict one's life, but rather reflect it. And she asks him how he became a printer. And he says it was kind of on accident. He'd been looking for a business that would help conceal and facilitate the smuggling, because he knew he wanted to do that. He found a shop, and it pretty much fell into his lap. And then he met Tom Gage, who was first a customer, and then over time, as they began to trust each other, and Gage began bringing Jamie materials to be printed, the content written by radical political writers, anonymous broadsheets, pamphlets, all very dangerous stuff, Jamie began to be involved, at least peripherally, in that. Jamie had taken three letters with him, the letters QED. Quote, the English took my sword and dirk away, but Tom Gage put a weapon into my hands again, and I think I shall not lay it down. Unquote. Something important to never forget. The pen is and will always be mightier than the sword.
Here.
But what about this scalpel?
That's just Claire. And we may get it. We'll have to see. Anne S. writes, and we get to what I really love about Jamie and Claire. Diana really does give Jamie the most beautiful and poetic prose. He tells Claire that just being with someone again he can tell his whole heart to is enough. Well, most of his heart, at least. He reflects on the effect of all the violence he has had on him. Is he anything more than a brute? At least with Claire, he can hope to be. Diana gives Jamie the printing as a way for him to continue to fight injustice, since he can't be a warrior his whole life. Yet we never get to see Jamie as a seditionist printer, only as a warrior as the adventure moves forward. Deborah C. writes, Jamie tells Claire how he came to be a printer as a cover for his smuggling. He pulls out the type slugs for QED, the author of the article Roger found with Jamie's handwritten notes. QED is the Latin abbreviation for the phrase quod erat demonstrandum, meaning which is what had to be shown, or thus it has been demonstrated. Eileen P. writes, I think when Jamie refers to himself as a brute, he might be showing guilt over Geneva's death bearing his child, but perhaps we're just getting a glimpse of Jamie with other women not yet mentioned in the novel. I recall Jamie's feral life in the cave and returning to civility when at Lallybroch. He's been a brute when he has had sex with other women, but with Claire, he is able to act out of love, which is how he has always wanted it to be.
I don't think he was a brute.
Are we forgetting the time that they were like angry screwing each other on the rug? Have we forgotten that?
Yeah, he's been a brute with her plenty of times, but I guess I don't think of him as being a brute with Geneva. I mean, yeah, at the beginning he, you know,
he sealed the deal.
But then after that, I mean, Diana was very explicit about how he wanted her to enjoy it and he took his time and he was very gentle and freaking cleaned her at the end. So, you know, that's not a brute's not going to do that.
Hours later, set to make their evening meeting with Ian, they're walking to Carfax Close.
Okay, so this is my favorite part, my favorite paragraph in the chapter, where Diana, I love it for a couple of reasons. One, for the setting, the mood of it, just before all hell breaks loose, and everything is just so peaceful and so descriptive. The city glowed all around us, as though sharing our happiness. Edinburgh lay under a haze that would soon thicken to rain again. But for now, the light of the setting sun hung gold and pink and red in the clouds and shone in the wet patina of the gold cobbled street, so that the gray stones of the buildings softened and streamed with reflected light. Echoing the glow that warmed my cheeks and shone in Jamie's eyes when he looked at me. I mean, it's like it's a perfect moment. It's one of those moments where if you could freeze time, that's where you would want to be, I think.
That's what I was thinking. It would be a frozen, yeah, exactly. Or a still.
And then you move on.
To me, it's a moment like that that tells me that something is about to go wrong.
Oh, yeah. It is. It's when you see a movie or a TV show or whatever, when it's this nice warm and fuzzy. And it's not just that it's pretty. It's like you can tell something bad or not so wonderful is going to happen. Not necessarily because it's a pretty shot, but because they linger on it. Because you know something's about to happen. Otherwise, they would never linger.
I've said this before. It's like the scene in City of Angels Meg Ryan is riding her bicycle down the road with her eyes shut, enjoying the morning, and then gets hit by a
big
rig.
This whole chapter is built up to this moment, you know, with them. The flirting and the Google eyes over the stew and licking of the fingers and then going up and talking and they're having word sex and now everything's perfect and they're walking and okay, that's all over.
outside of her dress tearing and her being hungry, it hasn't really gone that poorly for her since she's gone back. So she's needing a little bit of a, you know, culture shock.
Okay, so along with what you guys just said, which I didn't think of it in terms of like the setting and then the lingering and the scene, but we'll get there. I have something along those lines, and especially along the lines of what Summer just said. So they're walking to Carfax Close. On the way, someone behind them was a little impatient at their slowness, and he stops them up short, and Claire loses. He like comes around in front of them, and they stop short because they're almost going to run into him, and Claire loses a shoe. Now, they looked up at that moment and saw that there was a fire, and Jamie thought it was in Leith Wynd. Now, I want to know why people weren't running before someone shouted fire. That just sounds stupid to me. So the only person who might expect to walk briskly away from a fire is the person who said it on purpose. So now their reunion bliss, which is what you guys just described, their reunion bliss is about to end and another adventure to start. I wonder if Claire losing her shoe is a nod to Cinderella.
And I wonder if Daphne's feet are bigger than Claire's. Is that why her shoe came?
Oh, yeah, that's true. So one, because Cinderella, the etymology of that is ashes, and we're talking about a fire. So ashes and feminine. And in German, it's Aschenputtel, which literally means ashes combined with an untidy or dirty girl.
It sounded like you said ass poodle.
Two, because what follows is the end of their dreamy time together. And three, because life now returns to imbalance. Claire is also hopping awkwardly on one foot, hence the imbalance. So though she has retrieved her shoe, she didn't leave it in the street. She hasn't had a chance to put it on yet. So you have reference to Ash when there's a fire going on. She loses her shoe, which of course is a direct, or I should say an overt nod to Cinderella. But you have her losing her shoe, which would be, again, something kind of odd happening, or a loss of a change of a picture-perfect moment. Number two, the time is like a shift almost. And number three, because life is now literally out of balance. So she's literally hopping along. Alas, the fire is not in Leithwind. It is in Carfax Close. It's in the print shop. Jamie is mostly worried about his printing press because that's his livelihood. It's now their livelihood. And I put in all caps, he crawls into the burning building. Now, a few other men do follow. And in a little bit, men are throwing pieces of the press through the glass of the window to save them. Now, Ian, now this is Elder Ian, comes through the crowd and finds Claire. Several men were able to bring the press out of the shop. By this point, Ian clamps his hand around Claire's arm and yells, Ian. And I'm like, wait, why is Ian yelling Ian? Because I'm so used to young Ian being called young Ian. And like, oh, it's his son Ian. Got it. He had seen young Ian. By this time, Jamie is out of the shop recovering his breath. Ian attempts to enter the burning building himself, but Claire yells to Jamie to go get young Ian, who's on the second floor. Now, I had a little thought, and I've never thought about this before. Diana writes second story, so young Ian is on the second story. But I wonder if this is Diana's American showing. Is it American second story or British second story? Or does story literally mean level? Because we're not, no, she didn't use the word floor. Because an American second floor is the second level. In Britain, or as I should say, actually in Europe, typically, at least in Germany and in the UK, the first floor is, it is in Germany. So I'm sure it's in Europe. So in German, the ground level, it's called Erdgeschoss, literally ground level or ground floor. The first floor, I forget the word for floor. What is floor, Sam? Erste Flur, whatever. So it's this, the first level. It's the same thing in the UK. If you say I'm on the first floor, you go up one flight of stairs to the first floor. It's not the ground level. Ground level is the ground level, and then the first, second, and so on from here. In the US, nah. I guess we're lazy. But in the US, first floor is ground level. And so I was wondering, we know Ian's up. He's not on the ground because she says second. So in any case, he's at least up a level. But I was curious, did Diana make a mistake here? Did she truly mean second? Okay, number one, does second story cover it no matter what? So whether it's in the UK or in America, American English, is that second story mean it's the second level?
Yeah, but remember, this is Claire's perspective. So I would think for her.
Oh, well, I understand that. But Diana's writing it, and Diana has made mistakes before. So what I'm saying is, it's Claire's perspective, but it's Diana's words.
Ginger said that, not me. So
what?
I'm teasing you. You said it, not me.
Oh, hush. No, she's admitted that she's not, for example, that geography is not her strong point. She said that. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious. So maybe, and this just popped out because I thought, oh, I got the understanding that when we were in the print shop with Jamie and Claire, that it had two levels. Now, maybe it had three, I don't know, but I only understood it as having two levels. Mm-hmm. But it wouldn't be odd if it had three levels.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying? So mm-hmm. I'm just curious. It doesn't matter in the end. I was just curious, did Diana mean the second level, which would actually be the first floor in the UK and in Europe, but not in America? Or did she mean third floor?
Is this important because you're trying to gauge how high up he is?
No, it just caught me like, oh, I was wondering if Diana meant literally on the second level. Mm-hmm. And I've never wondered that ever in this. I never stopped. So I was curious if she meant it.
You're not stopping now.
I was wondering. Oh, Summer. I was wondering if she said it with knowledge of European versus American English wording in describing buildings and floors. That's all. So Jamie shoves, he gets Ian and he brings him outside and he shoves Ian at Claire. Excuse me. Back up. Before he goes in, Ian, as I said, was trying to go into the building and Jamie stops him.
Okay,
that's the cat food again. Ian is trying to get inside to get his son, and Jamie is holding him back. Before Jamie himself goes in to get young Ian, he shoves Ian, the elder, toward Claire. He tells her to hold on tight, and she's holding him around the waist. And then Jamie climbs up a neighboring building's stairs to get to young Ian. Jamie's finally able to get to him, and he calls for a rope, which he gets, and he and young Ian come safely to the ground.
Well, Ian, elder Ian, is about a quarter more flammable than everyone else in
that's
the
true.
Area.
Or at least an eighth, yeah.
So it makes sense that we push him away from said fire.
Yeah.
We know how long it took him to carve a new leg the last time it happened.
Oh my gosh.
I'm really curious how much of this is in the show. Yeah, I mean, because that's a lot, you know, to do.
Well,
that.
We know they have a print shop because that's like, they've already said it. Yeah. But if there's a print shop, you almost have to have a fire. I mean, otherwise, because you have to push the story forward, is what I'm saying.
Here's one way to be able to tell.
I'm just wondering how much of it they're going to be doing. Is it going to be a lot of stunt work, or is it just going to be a fire? Is it going to be aftermath? You know, because that's a lot.
It is. But,
all I know is that we'll have to pay close attention to any pictures of young Ian that come out and see if he has eyebrows.
He's also very blonde, very blonde.
I think they'll leave his eyebrows.
No, but even blonde eyebrows when burnt off.
No, I know, but what I'm saying is I don't know that they're going to dye his hair because we haven't seen any. At least we haven't seen it.
Oh, but I could easily see them not showing them. They haven't released any pictures of any of the new actors in character, have they? I mean,
Not officially, but we've seen. There have been people who have shared things privately that are of
privately. Oh. They've been all over Twitter.
Privy, I guess.
I understand that, but I don't go looking for it. Someone sent us something privately and I did view it, but I didn't announce it.
Well, I don't go looking for it, but it pops up in my Twitter feed.
Apparently, I'm not on Twitter that much.
Oh, that's a bold-faced lie.
Summer, when I go to Twitter, I post or I reply. Or I retweet. I don't go looking for stuff. I'm very narrowly focused on Twitter. I don't sit there and look for things. I don't see the stuff because we follow so many people. I can't keep, there's no way to find it. So young Ian apparently isn't a pretty picture post-fire. And just in time, because the roof of the shop collapses. Eileen P. writes, I noticed Claire didn't try to stop Jamie from entering a flaming building. Here she is reunited with him after 20 years, but she doesn't try to stop him. Then it dawned on me that Claire trusts Jamie's instincts and abilities, and she must think he's invincible because of all he's survived. Jamie is a superhero. When young Ian was rescued from the fire, Ian didn't know whether to hug him or reprimand him. It reminded me of Claire's reaction to Fergus sneaking off to fight at Preston Pans. They make their way to Madame Jeanne's, and people are laughing at young Ian's appearance. Diana says, quote, with his singed hair, swollen red face, beaky nose and lashless, blinking eyes. Let me try that again. With his singed hair, swollen red face, beaky nose, and lashless, blinking eyes, he strongly resembled the fledgling young of some exotic bird species. A newly hatched flamingo, perhaps. Unquote. Safely up in a room, young Ian tells his tale. He starts with, he set the fire. Young Ian had gone to a tavern where he'd seen a man asking for Jamie by his real name, Jamie or James Fraser or Jamie Roy. The tavern keeper had feigned ignorance of the name Jamie Fraser, and then the seaman mentioned Jamie Roy. The landlord continued his ignorance. Diana said he was deaf, but I got the hint that it was ignorance, and he tried to pay him, but he still didn't do it or say anything. So the man leaves, and young Ian follows him. Young Ian follows him into another tavern, the Green Owl, and Claire has some reaction to this name. We don't know what it is yet, but Claire kind of peeks up at the, sits up at the name. Now, it was crowded, but everyone shut up when they saw young Ian. The seaman asks about Jamie. No one knows.
You're such a juvenile.
The man had gone from tavern to tavern. Jamie's mind is working now, and he takes in young Ian's story of how they went from pub to pub, the man buying a brandy at each but never drinking it. He had tasted only at a place called Dog and Gun and at the Blue Boar. Jamie seems to have caught on to something. So young Ian followed this man and drank the brandy. And he'd had about 2 quarts of ale. He, of course, ended up falling asleep. Now, meanwhile, it's like a 5-mile walk that this man is doing, and he's following him. And he's tired from the walk and from not a lot of sleep and not a lot to eat and all the brandy. So he falls asleep in a corner. And he wakes up later, and the semen was gone. So he came to...
The semen was gone.
I really can't. I'm sorry. Can we say sailor?
Did he say he fell asleep in the corner of one of the taverns? Is that where he fell asleep?
I don't know. Something.
I hate it when I fall asleep and then I wake up and the semen is gone. It's just gone. Where did it go?
So we came to the Kittlehoosie and Jamie was gone. And that's when he saw Claire, right?
I'm sorry. That's the best place to go when you're looking for semen is the Kittlehoosie.
Kittlehoosie?
Whatever it is.
At this point, young Ian is belligerent when Ian gets after Jamie for having his son meet him at a bawdy house. He accuses him of cheating on his mom with Claire, the filthy whore. Now, did we mention that young Ian is still quite drunk? Young Ian is shocked to learn that Claire is his auntie, and he's disbelieving, quote, "But you're dead," unquote. Then we get a sense of how Claire has really lived on in Scotland the last 20 years. Quote, young Ian says, some of the old women at Lallybroch say you were a wise woman, a white lady, or maybe even a fairy, unquote. There was a mystery surrounding her disappearance. Ian jumps in to save the day. Quote, she escaped to France after Culloden, unquote. So I guess that's the story we're going with. Then, quote, young Ian's mouth hung open slightly. So did mine, unquote. This is Claire's observation. I can just imagine her going like, oh, is that what happened to me? Young Ian says, so you've come back to him. God, that's romantic.
God, don't you love him? Oh my God, I love him.
Oh, he's the best. He's the best. He's the best.
That of the all of the people in the room... Ian is the one who came up with the best backstory of where she's been. And it's one that's totally plausible.
For them, yeah.
Right. I could totally buy it and it makes sense. But like of all the time that Claire's had to think of it and Jamie's had 2 days to think of it now. And Ian's had literally, 6 hours? And he's come up with the best answer.
Huh. So young Ian, because he's still drunk and all that stuff, has been throwing up into, I guess, a spittoon, she calls it, and or some kind of vessel. And Claire takes the vomitus out and gets some supplies and tea and something for them to eat. And she misses some of the conversation. And she knows this because when they come in, it's their body language and their silence and different things. So she's handing out the supplies when she comes back and she educates them on the treatment of burns. And their Ian's story continues. Young Ian thought to intercept the man by getting ahead of him and trying other taverns to see if he could find him and see maybe the direction he was going or whatever. And he finds him. At this spot, though, the man was drinking beer, so he was taking a break. After that, he went straight to Carfax Close. Young Ian saw that the man was looking at the shop, up and down, like he was inspecting it to try and get in. You know, casing the joint. The man meant to go around the alley to the back of the close. Young Ian knew this, and then he thought of the back door and the thousands of seditious pamphlets that would have been waiting for him inside the shop in the back. Young Ian had been trying to save Jamie. He set fire to the shop because he knew what those pamphlets held. Meanwhile, Ian is livid that Jamie would involve his son in it, but also that he'd endanger himself and their family, what with everything he'd and they had gone through. Tensions are high between the two. Jamie had planned to take young Ian home to Lallybroch with him so that he could ask their permission for him to come live with him in Edinburgh for a time. Ian goes to leave and take young Ian with him, but the latter refuses to leave. He says he'll go in the morning, but not just now. And he did this to get him to leave so he could tell Jamie the rest of the story. Of course, Elder Ian is probably, honestly, extremely hurt, pissed off, but just, I think, gutted and a lot of stuff. I really feel for Ian here. He says that he thinks he killed the seaman.
It can only live for so long outside of your body.
The man who broke into the shop. Now, he had scared the man who'd turned on him with the gun, and he threw the only weapon he could find quickly at him. It was a long-handled copper ladle used to pour lead from the melting pot, molten lead from the melting pot into the casting molds. There was still molten lead in it. He threw it at the man's face. The man, scratching at his face where the lead had hit, had actually set the fire when he was backing up and knocking things over. He upset a forge which still had live coals in it. Young Ian is ashamed that he may have killed this man, and he is afraid for his soul, and that's why he can't face his parents. It turns out that young Ian wanted to tell Jamie because he knew he'd killed men before, but he didn't think his father ever had. Jamie helps young Ian process the taking of a life, even the inadvertent taking of a life, assures him that it wasn't a mortal sin and it was in self-defense. He puts his mind at ease and tells him some prayers he can say before making a confession and to pray for the other man's
soul. That's going to be a great scene. That's such a touching, wonderful scene.
Oh, are you kidding me? I agree with you. Anne S. writes, and then all heck breaks loose. Not only do we have one murder under our belt, we add a one-eyed pirate, a fire, a rescue only Jamie the King of Men could pull off, and yes, another murder by a drunken teen in about 5 pages.
And let's forget about all the seamen.
Oh, Lord. Well, the seaman was the pirate. But yeah. I would have said pirate would have been much easier to say than seaman anyway.
Yeah, but that seaman got around. He was at all those bars.
I know.
He ended up back at the print shop.
Good thing Uncle Jamie is so experienced at killing. He knows just what young Ian needs to feel better. Prayer. Eileen P. writes, it is so sweet to have a character that is a teenage boy who is so romantic. Quote, so you've come back to him. God, that's romantic. Aye, young Ian, it is. And finally, Martina P. writes, is it just my observation, or has Ian Murray Sr. become bitter in 20 years? What happened to calm and wise Ian Murray? He is particularly hard on Jamie, and in my opinion, rather unfair. Maybe his accusatory comments and attitude toward Jamie can be partially excused by his troubles and worries over young Ian. Considering everything Jamie does and has sacrificed to take care of Lallybroch, Jenny and all their children, as well as tenants, Ian seems ungrateful to me. Jamie's smuggling and all other undertakings that Ian is so critical of sustain his and his children's life, after all. My judgment might be a little clouded by the memories of Stephen Cree's sweet portrayal of Ian.
Well, the Scots have gone through a hell of a lot in the last 20 years. I mean, we know for a fact that poor Ian was put into prison, I guess, a couple of times being questioned. So,
several times.
He's bitter. I don't know. I think he's coming out pretty good considering what he's been through. You know, I think he's totally justified, and I don't think he's out of character at all. That's my two cents. Well, these are two. I'm so glad these two chapters are really great. I mean, there's so much happens, there's lots of room for what Kat has promised, more sex in this season. So, there's lots of room for that. And there's lots of comedy, there's sentimentality, there's action, there's new characters that are introduced and reintroduced. I mean, so much happens in these two books. And then, of course, this is kind of almost at the pivot where we're about to springboard into our next adventure. So,
and that was chapter 27. Join us next time when we discuss chapter 28, entitled Virtue's Guardian.
Okay, so that is this the end of a part as well or not yet?
Nope.
Not yet. Okay. Sorry, getting ahead of myself. These are some long chapters. I think from here on out, there's like a chapter that's 30-something pages, so that beats this one. But I think we've got a little bit of time until we have such long chapters again. Is that right?
That was like 3 weeks marathon in a chapters. Row.
Yeah.
Long chapters.
Well, the print shop isn't that long. It's that we did 24 and 25 together, which together were decently long. But 26 and 27 were crazy long. Mm-hmm. So thank you, Candida, for joining us.
Thank you for having me, ladies. I always enjoy it.
Of course. And thank you, dear listener, as always, so much for joining us. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20. Outlander20 for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.